You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Joel Larza.
And I'm Kelly Sergenis. It's too packaged. There are too many commercial breaks. And key competitions are broadcast with frustrating time delays, so they are seen during prime time. Welcome to the drama-filled, not entirely live Rio Olympics NBC style. American television viewers and analysts are taking the network to task over its coverage of the Summer Games. The problems began with last Friday's opening ceremony, which was broadcast with a delay and interrupted with a series of pre-produced segments and interviews, meaning not all of the actual ceremony was shown. Toby Berkovitz, a professor of advertising at Boston University, said American consumers who now have a wide array of streaming and viewing options are increasingly demanding.
I'll give you a little hint on watching the Olympics coverage on NBC for the remainder of the games. If it says live in the upper right-hand corner of your TV screen, the event you are watching is indeed live. If that word is not there, you're watching a tape delay. Shortly before the games launched on August 5th, John Miller, the NBC Olympics chief marketing officer, offered an explanation for why so many Olympic events, and particularly the opening ceremony, are aired on a tape delay, even for those who live on the East Coast, only an hour off the time in Rio, to say nothing of the West Coast, which gets everything on tape delay. For example, all the women's gymnastics events have taken place in the afternoon this week. All of them. That glitzy, sparkly red, white, and blue coverage you've been watching at 8 and 10 o'clock Eastern Time has actually been completed hours earlier. I have to pull up ESPN.com on my phone to get the results because I'm a sports fan. I have little use for the entertainment packages NBC puts together for the events. And if you think all this tape delaying is bad now, the next three Olympics are in Asia, which is 12 or more hours ahead of us. The figure skating at the Winter Olympics in 2018 will have been completed in the middle of the night before. NBC does stream some of the events live on their app. You can watch all events live for a $15 one-month subscription. If you're a stickler for live coverage, this is your best bet.
In addition to all of this, Jonathan Tannenwald, a Philadelphia Inquirer, reported the following comment. The people who watch the Olympics are not particularly sports fans. More women watch the games than men, and for the women, they're less interested in the result and more interested in the journey. It's sort of like the ultimate reality show and miniseries wrapped into one. And while ratings for the 2016 games in Rio have sagged compared to those for the 2012 games in London, they're still performing well. Clearly, most people are content enough to watch the product NBC offers. The problem for many sports fans is that NBC has no competition. But the big problem, according to Todd Vanderwerf at Vox.com, is that NBC treats the Olympics not as a sporting event, but as entertainment. He says they treat the Olympics as a soft-focused entertainment event, just like their news magazine, Dateline. NBC has the rights to both the Summer and Winter Olympics locked up through 2032, including streaming rights. So treating the games as entertainment, and on tape delay no less, will continue for a long, long time.
We keep hearing stories in the media about illnesses that were once effectively attacked by antibiotics are now resistant to them. Additionally, scientists are bracing themselves for a future superbug that could be totally resistant to antibiotics altogether. Now there's a new discovery that has researchers jumping for joy. It's called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, a dramatic discovery in gene editing that may give us a powerful tool to fight disease. It's totally revolutionizing biology, and we're only at the beginning, says James Dahlman, a chemical and bioengineer at the Georgia Institute of Technology.
The discovery that could change the world came about when one of science's worst fears was realized, the superbug. People have worried about it for years, a superbug fueled by bacteria that can withstand the most powerful antibiotics. And now it's here. In the U.S., In April, a 49-year-old woman went to a clinic in Pennsylvania with symptoms of a urinary tract infection. Researchers soon learned she had a gene that made her infection resistant to all antibiotics. The medicine cabinet is empty for some patients, CDC Director Thomas Frieden told the National Press Club after the discovery. It is the end of the road for antibiotics unless we act urgently. Fortunately for all of us, scientists are acting urgently. The results are promising. The CRISPR revolution started on the smallest of scales. It comes from bacteria, and maybe it has come in the nick of time. Antibiotics and drugs like them have been used for more than 70 years. They've saved the lives of millions, but often they're overprescribed. As a result, we're seeing the rise of resistant bacteria that no longer give in to the drugs that once did the job.
This is creating a huge challenge for our medical system, says MIT's Timothy Liu, MD, PhD, one of the leading researchers in the world of CRISPR. Antibiotics work on bacterial infections. They don't work on viruses, but Liu says some doctors will give you an antibiotic even if it's not designed to cure what you have. Another challenge with antibiotics is that they kill both good and bad bacteria, Liu says. So drug choices for a lot of bacteria infections are becoming limited. In the case of the superbug, there are no known drug choices. As if things weren't already dicey, each year, drug-resistant bacteria cause about 23,000 deaths. But as infections have grown stronger, so have the tools of science. Then researchers made a major discovery. They discovered CRISPR molecules in nature. It's something microbes have used to defend themselves from viruses for millions of years. They're made up of repeating genetic sequences. These patterns are interrupted by things called spacers. They're leftovers of genetic code from past invaders, like a virus. So the CRISPR system is like a genetic memory bank that helps the body find and destroy invaders when and if they return. Over the past several years, scientists have figured out how to engineer CRISPR to edit the genetic makeup of human cells.
Today, you may hear about something called the CRISPR-Cas9 system. Cas9 is a chemical your body makes that acts like a pair of scissors, cutting away offending DNA. So basically, CRISPR-Cas9 is a precision tool that can be used to target specific stretches of genetic code, editing DNA, cutting and pasting, if you will. In the 3 years since the scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, Harvard, and MIT demonstrated the CRISPR gene editing tool, hundreds of experiments using it have followed. Some of the results, like those from the labs of Dahlman and Liu, may herald a new age in medicine. Dahlman's lab is working on genetic drugs that can target complicated combinations of genes simultaneously. And Liu's lab has used CRISPR to selectively kill bacteria that has genes prone to antibiotic resistance or to cause disease. Right now, that's Liu's life's work. Since I was a PhD student, my goal has been to develop new alternative sources of therapeutics to fight against disease, he says. And that could change which medicines doctors give you and when.
Because of CRISPR, short for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats, by the way, researchers foresee a time when devastating genetic conditions will be effectively treated and when many diseases will be eliminated. Among the ones CRISPR is expected to help are hemophilia, sickle cell anemia, and HIV. We're definitely not there yet, but the path seems clear. We're already doing studies that we could only dream about just 4 years ago, Dahlman says, and one of the best parts about it is that the technology doesn't exactly break the bank for the labs that are doing the research. This incredibly powerful tool allows you to do gene editing at a cost and scale that is unprecedented, Liu says. So the clamor over CRISPR in the scientific community has reached crescendo levels, and for good reason. This is world-changing technology, he said. This is really about the democratization of science, Liu says.
If you're like most Americans, you've been watching at least some coverage of the Summer Olympics in Rio. You probably also saw the U.S. women's gymnasts tear it up in all events. And you most likely saw Michael Phelps help his relay team win the gold medal in the 4x100 freestyle relay. That one was Phelps's 19th gold medal, which is unprecedented in Olympics history. Now he has 22. You may have also noticed something else. You may have seen some huge welts all over Phelps's back and side. Maybe the boys got rowdy in the dorms throwing tennis balls too hard at one another. Nope. We looked into what this really is, and it's a type of therapy called cupping, which has become popular among swimmers and other athletes.
Cupping is used to help blood flow in problematic areas for swimmers. It uses suction cups to help improve blood flow for muscles that have become sore. Basically, cupping involves a cup attached to a pump. Athletes put the cup on their skin and create suction with the pump. Some say the technique increases blood flow to help a person's sore muscles heal. According to WebMD, cupping therapy dates back to ancient Egyptian, Chinese, and Middle Eastern cultures. Phelps apparently uses a version of the therapy that involves heat to create suction. It was even featured in his Under Armour ad announcing his return to competitive swimming. The suction typically lasts for only a few minutes, but it's enough time to cause the capillaries just beneath the surface to rupture, creating the circular, eye-catching bruises that have been so visible on Mr. Phelps, as well as members of the United States men's gymnastics team. If the bruising effect looks oddly familiar, it's because it's the same thing that happens when someone has a hickey.
While there's no question that many athletes, coaches, and trainers believe in the treatment, there's not much science to determine whether cupping offers real physiological benefit or whether the athletes simply are enjoying a placebo effect. A few years ago, the Denver Broncos player DeMarcus Ware posted a photo on Instagram showing his back covered with 19 clear cups as a therapist held a flame used to heat the cup before placing it on the skin. Celebrities, including Jennifer Aniston and Gwyneth Paltrow, have also been photographed with cupping marks on their skin. As long as they keep winning gold medals and it's not against Olympics training rules, I suspect you'll see a lot more of it in the future. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Kelly Sergenis.
And I'm Joe Lerza. Finally, there's some good news regarding our nation's brave veterans. Veteran homelessness has dropped nearly in half since 2010. Thanks to partnerships and programming, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, announced this week. On a given night in January, there were fewer than 40,000 homeless veterans, according to the country's annual point-in-time count. That marked a 47% decrease since the same count was conducted 6 years prior. The success was due to the White House's first-ever strategic plan to end veteran homelessness and a unique partnership between HUD and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Through the collaboration, HUD provides rental assistance to homeless veterans, and the VA complements it with case management and clinical services. Since 2010, more than 360,000 veterans and their families have been permanently housed, rapidly rehoused, or were spared from becoming homeless through HUD and VA programs.
Remember that the title of this segment is News Out of the Box. Sometimes out of the box means going where we don't want to go because the mainstream media is not telling you the truth. This is one of those stories. This is not meant to scare you by any means. It is based on research and science, and maybe knowing about it can cause people to take precautions prescribed by their doctor so this does not happen to them. More women are dying in childbirth in the United States than in any other developed country, and that number is rapidly growing. And experts say the problem is likely to keep getting worse.
In other countries, maternal death rates have fallen sharply since 1990. In South Korea, the rate of women dying in childbirth fell from 20.7 deaths per 100,000 live births in 1990 to only 12 today. In Germany, it dropped from 18 to 6.5. But in the United States, the opposite is happening. The rate of women dying in childbirth is going up. Pregnancy-related COVID deaths are still rare events in the U.S. Only about 700 women die out of 4 million live births annually. But the U.S. is one of the few rich countries in the world where maternal mortality is steadily rising. The maternal mortality rate has more than doubled since 1987. The first year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention began collecting data through its pregnancy mortality surveillance system. And experts are just now understanding why this is happening, why the United States looks so different from other countries, and why so many more new mothers are dying. They think maternal deaths are rising because of the rising toll of chronic diseases.
30 years ago, women died in the delivery room because of hemorrhages and pregnancy-induced blood pressure spikes. Now, they are much more likely to die because of pre-existing chronic conditions like heart disease or diabetes. Cardiovascular diseases are now the second leading cause of pregnancy-related deaths in the United States. 30 years ago, almost a third of all pregnancy-related deaths were because of hemorrhages or women bleeding to death. But today, that number has dropped by nearly a third. Hemorrhages now account for 11.4% of pregnancy-related deaths. Deaths related to embolisms and pregnancy-related hypertension disorders have also steadily declined, and deaths due to anesthesia complications have almost entirely disappeared. Fewer women are dying from emergency pregnancy complications.
Instead, more women are dying from pregnancy complications related to pre-existing chronic diseases, in particular, cardiovascular diseases. Cardiovascular conditions are now the second leading cause of pregnancy-related deaths, falling right behind non-cardiovascular diseases. And when combined with cardiomyopathy, diseases related to weakened heart muscle tissue, cardiovascular disorders make up more than a quarter of all pregnancy-related deaths. 30 years ago, cardiovascular diseases accounted for less than 10% of all pregnancy-related deaths. But as of 1998 to 2005, CDC researchers noted their increased prevalence as a leading cause of death to 14.6%. Part of the uptick in cardiovascular-related deaths is because more pregnant women in the U.S. have chronic health conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, and obesity, all of which put them at a much greater risk for pregnancy complications. While the risk of dying in childbirth goes up with the age of the mothers, experts don't think older women having children in the U.S. help move the dial of maternal deaths.
One stark and somewhat inexplicable trend in pregnancy-related deaths is that black women are significantly more likely to die than their peers. Studies have shown that black women are less likely to begin prenatal care in the first trimester and are more likely to have pre-existing chronic conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, or obesity than white women. But this still doesn't account for the enormity of the disparity that currently exists. Black women are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy complications than white women. What's more, researchers found this to be true regardless of age, education, or similarities in living conditions. And the disparity is growing worse.
The maternal death rate for black women rose from 34% in 2007 to 42.8% in 2011. During the same time period, the maternal death rate for white women only increased by 0.7 percentage points. Sadly, this finding is not all that surprising. Black people, and in particular black women, are significantly more likely to die from a health condition than their peers. But according to Dr. Callahan, the differences in the maternal death rates for white and black women are currently the most severe disparity in U.S. healthcare. Experts say 1 in 3 maternal deaths are preventable. So public health officials are now working on a national initiative to review every single pregnancy-related death in America. And the movement is building momentum. Here's how it works. A board of medical experts in each state meets and reviews information on every single maternal death in that state, looking at potential issues ranging from prenatal care to the role pre-existing health conditions played.
The idea is that by determining the causes of each maternal death, trends will emerge, which will in turn help doctors and healthcare providers identify how to best prevent maternal deaths. The CDC and AMCHP are providing technical infrastructure to help states collect and analyze data collected by the individual review boards. The current plan is to establish an active review board in all 50 states and produce a national report so that lessons can be more readily shared between states and healthcare providers.
Some scientists are calling a discovery in China's Yellow River Valley evidence that supports a biblical flood. OneNewsNow.com reports that archaeologists recently uncovered bones of children in the Yellow River Valley. The children appear to have been trapped by a massive flood. The bones have been dated to around 2000 BC, which is consistent with when scientists and historians believe the biblical account of Noah's flood occurred.
Prominent biblical apologist and scientist Ken Ham, who is also the head of the Creation Museum and the newly opened Ark Encounter attraction, noted that China, like many cultures, has a story of a great flood. Whether it's the American Indians or the Fijians, Hawaiians, the Eskimos, Australian Aborigines, back to the Babylonians, there are flood legends in cultures all over the world, Ham explained. In this particular flood legend from China, when you read it, it talks about it was basically a global flood, the way it was described. And there was a man in particular associated with that flood, he continued. Many scientists and the media, however, deny that the flood that buried the children's bones in the Yellow River Valley was part of the biblical flood in Genesis.
There are thousands of feet of flood sediment all over the globe, evidence of a catastrophic global flood. And they're not prepared to look at that because they've been indoctrinated to believe that that was laid down over millions of years, Ham said. Ham believes that an unwillingness to embrace spiritual truths caused many people to be blinded to scientific truths.
About 3 out of 10 billionaires, 29.9%, around the world did not have at least a bachelor's degree in 2015, according to a billionaire census by WealthX. That's 739 out of the total 2,473 billionaires.
The percentage of billionaires with a university degree has fallen sharply since 2014, when roughly 35% of billionaires had no degree. Quite a few billionaires then joined the ranks of Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, who left Harvard during his sophomore year and now claims a $53.5 billion net worth, and Microsoft founder Bill Gates, who also bowed out of the same university in 1975. The vast majority of billionaires, however, did make it to a bachelor's degree, and many went farther. 22% went to nab a master's degree, while 13.1% of all billionaires earned an MBA. About 9.5% took home a PhD, 3.4% can tout a JD, and a lesser 0.7% can hang an MD behind their desk. Some universities also tend to produce more billionaires.
Harvard University is the most popular destination by far among billionaires, awarding twice as many degrees as the runner-up, Stanford University. In comparison, just 30% of Fortune 500 CEOs have just a bachelor's degree.
Jenny Stepien's father was murdered 10 years ago. His wishes were to donate as many of his organs as possible. Meanwhile, Arthur Thomas had been waiting 16 years for a heart until he received Michael Stepien's heart in 2006. Fast forward to a couple of months ago while Jenny was planning her wedding. On a whim, Jenny wrote Mr. Thomas a letter, and she said, "I am the daughter of the man whose heart is inside of you, and I'm going to get married on August 6th, the letter said. And one thing further, if you're willing, would you walk me down the aisle?" Last Friday, Jenny felt her father's heart beat for the first time in 10 years. And then very proudly, Arthur Thomas, with Jenny Stepien's dad's heart in his chest, walked Jenny down the aisle to the waiting arms of her new husband.
One U.S. university is far and away contributing the most athletes to this year's Olympic team than any other, and that's Stanford University. 31 Stanford students and alumni are participating in swimming, diving, water polo, sailing, rowing, soccer, tennis, volleyball, equestrian, rugby, and fencing events this year, according to information provided by the U.S. Olympic Committee. The university has produced at least one medalist in every Olympics in which the U.S. has competed since 1912. Bernard Muir, Stanford's athletic director, says this achievement is synonymous with Stanford Athletics' reputation as the nation's most successful athletics program. The next closest to Stanford in the number of athletes competing in Rio is the University of California at Berkeley, with 16 student athletes. UCLA, USC, and Penn State round out the top five of most athletes at the Olympics this summer in Rio. 75% of the 2016 U.S. Olympic team competed in collegiate athletics at the varsity and club levels. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be back after these messages.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Kelly Sirgenis.
And I'm Joel Lerza. Raising the minimum wage has its consequences. First, it's sales. Wendy's sales are plummeting. They're struggling to comply with minimum wage increases. The same has happened to McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, and Starbucks, as they each posted disappointing same restaurant sales for the quarter ending June 30th. After falling sales comes layoffs. You can expect to hear about mass layoffs at companies that typically hire minimum wage earning workers. As the wage goes up, somebody has to pay the piper, and that's usually seen in laying off workers. The next shoe to fall will be closing lower performing stores, and that's a loss of lots of jobs. So across the board, minimum wage hikes can hurt a lot of people. If you want my 2 cents worth, I think the federal minimum wage should be repealed. Let each state decide for itself. Many already are.
Olympic swimming, excellent swimmers. They've been swimming almost their entire lives. Nothing could go wrong, right? Not so fast. If you look closely around the pool deck at the Olympic swimming and diving events in Rio this week, you'll see lifeguards, several of them working shifts just like they would at a municipal pool filled with kids. Why do Olympic events need lifeguards? Because you never know what can go wrong. Seizures, head injuries, especially at the diving events, severe cramps, ever had one of those at the swimming pool, and heart attacks. We've all heard news stories about basketball, soccer, and football players dying on the playing field due to a heart attack. It can even happen at a swimming pool.
The odds of an emergency are small, and the lifeguards know this, but they're nearby in case that one in a million event happens. It's a Brazilian law that any public pool over a certain size has to have lifeguards. Ricardo Prado, the sports manager for Aquatics, told Reuters, "We wish we didn't have them either at the games, but we have to have them," he said. "All are certified men and women with red and yellow uniforms and equipped with whistles and floats. For the record, no swimmer in Olympic history has ever needed rescuing, but the lifeguards remain on duty just in case." The lifeguards at the Rio Games have perhaps the best view in the house, as they are among the few people permitted on the pool deck. They might not feel particularly useful, but there they are. Two lifeguards in red trunks with whistles around their necks and flotation devices tucked beneath their arms. They never use their whistles. They never once yelled at the Olympians to stop running on the pool deck. By appearances, the Olympic lifeguards are of the same breed as those who coolly oversee the hijinks at the community pool and are prepared to dive in to rescue a struggling or sinking swimmer. There are about 75 of them hired to work the Olympic sites and training centers for swimming, diving, synchronized swimming, water polo, and whitewater kayaking.
They never flinched toward action or even felt their hearts skip a beat faster at the sudden and momentary possibility. Is she still underwater? That someone may need saving. A lifeguard might come in handy in a few events. Water polo can get ruggedly physical. Synchronized swimming is a surprisingly frequent source of sports concussions. Divers risk smacking the water. But at the swimming pool, 10 feet deep for events like the 50-meter sprint and the breaststroke, They need a lifeguard or two? Yes, it's necessary, said 25-year-old Danielle Martlot, the lifeguard supervisor at the Olympic Aquatic Stadium. She cited the possibilities of debilitating cramps, heart attacks, and head-crunching crashes into the wall. We hope that they don't need our intervention, she said. And if your son or daughter competitive swimmer had a seizure in the water or hit their head, wouldn't you want trained help and rescue equipment nearby?
So let's say you're a little down in the dumps. Are there any foods you can eat to boost your mood? According to WebMD, the answer is a resounding yes. Number one, top of the list, you already knew this, is chocolate. It's not your imagination. Chocolate is a known joy stimulant.
According to a study published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, those who drank a polyphenol-rich chocolate drink once daily, which is the equivalent of 1.5 ounces of dark chocolate, reported feeling calmer and more content than those who did not. Cocoa boosts brain serotonin, says ethnobotanist Chris the Medicine Hunter Killam, who has traveled the world in search of traditional plant-based medicines. Almost every single antidepressant aims at either enhancing serotonin or keeping it in the brain longer. Chocolate or cocoa does that very well. So if you're craving chocolate, what you really could be craving isn't something sweet, but something to make you smile. A lot of people self-medicate with chocolate, says Killam. Women do that prior to and during menstruation when brain serotonin goes down. Chocolate will help boost that back up. And a lot of people just plain like the mood that it puts them in. Can you eat your way to a better mood? You sure can. And chocolate isn't the only known path to pleasure.
Here are some good mood foods to reach for when you need a boost. Protein. When you've got a case of the 3 p.m. munchies, the last thing you should reach for is a can of soda or a bag of candy. What you need is protein, says Marcel Pick, OBGYN, NP, author of Is It Me or My Hormones? Grab almond butter with half an apple, or a cheese stick, or some carrots and hummus. Protein keeps blood sugar stable, and you'll have sustained energy, she said. The more energy you have, the better your mood.
Bananas. Add a banana to your lunch or your smoothie, and you'll not only get a sweet treat, but an extra shot of dopamine. The humble banana contains up to 10 milligrams of dopamine. Dopamine is our primary reward chemical, says Killam. You know that enormous amount of pleasure you get when standing under a hot shower? You feel that because your body is producing dopamine. So anytime you get extra dopamine, that's going to have a beneficial effect on mind and mood.
Here's my favorite. Coffee and tea. Have you ever gone from grumpy to glorious in the time it takes you to down your first cup of coffee? Thank the caffeine, a natural mood lifter. Caffeine is spectacularly good for us, says Killam. It enhances mood and improves cognitive function overall.
Turmeric. This yellow spice, commonly used in East Asian cooking, contains curcumin. Curcumin demonstrates neuroprotective properties in the brain, enhances mood, and there is some evidence it helps against depression, says Killam.
Purple berries. Blueberries and blackberries contain purple pigment called anthocyanin, which, aside from being a heart-healthy antioxidant, is also a mood enhancer. And remember from a story we ran a few weeks ago that eating blueberries every day helps ward off Alzheimer's disease.
Omega-3 fatty acids. The fats found in salmon, sardines, and fish oil supplements contain the fatty acid DHA. Our bodies can't produce their own DHA. And people with low DHA are more prone to depression. DHA has a beneficial effect on mind and mood and is very active in the brain, says Killam.
And here's a few foods that can bring you down. First is sugar. Whether it's from soda or from cupcakes, we're just consuming too much of it, says Pick. Fluctuations in blood sugar cause mood swings, lack of energy, inability to lose weight, and pre-diabetes. If you want something sweet, reach for a piece of fruit instead. Also, gluten. If you have inflammation from or a reaction to gluten, it can actually affect brain function and certainly energy, says Pick. It also can affect the adrenal gland, which is responsible for producing the hormone cortisol, which plays a major role in stress response, immunity, and the functioning of your nervous system.
AOL Finance is out with a list of five things you should never keep in your wallet or purse. The risk of identity fraud is so high today that any of these things in your wallet or purse could give crooks free access to your identity.
Number one on the list is your Social Security card. Your Social Security number is the most vital piece of information for identity thieves, and the damage resulting from identity theft can impact your finances for years to come, said Michael Broomer, Vice President of Consumer Protection at credit reporting company Experian. Number two is your birth certificate or passport. Like your Social Security number, these items contain some vital, personally identifiable information, and losing these will make it all too easy for thieves to steal your identity, Broomer said. Third are extra credit cards. If your wallet or purse is stolen and you have eight credit cards in there, that's eight companies you have to call to notify of the theft. One or two are the best bet.
Number four is pins and passwords. Broomer says to leave these at home, especially your pin for the debit card that's in your wallet. Number five is your checkbook. If this is stolen, it'll take more than stopping payment with the bank. It will probably mean closing the old account and opening a new one.
A couple of New Zealand's businessmen are making a big splash in the country's rising homelessness population. Homelessness is a huge problem in Auckland, New Zealand. Property prices have increased almost 80% over the past 5 years, making the city's housing market one of the most expensive in the world. That's why Gary House and his colleagues are considering purchasing a 400-bed cruise liner to dock in Auckland.
Living on a cruise ship is not a long-term solution, House told The Guardian, but things are so bad for so many families now, it could help ease the pressure for 2 or 3 years while longer-term strategies are put into place. The philanthropists have received some negative responses about the quality of life on the cruise ship, but House's enthusiasm is unmoving. People would not be on the ship 24/7. They'd be getting off, going to work, living normal lives, but at least at night they could return to a bed and not a park in the middle of the winter. Currently, dozens of families are sleeping in cars, garages, and parks due to homelessness. House estimates he could have the cruise liner ready in a month. Hiramon Dennis, the chairman of Te Pue Mure, an area providing shelter to homeless families in Auckland, supports House's plan.
It's obviously a short-term solution, but I support any proposal that will get people out of cars and into something warmer and bigger, says Hiramon. At the moment, there is nowhere short-term for people in desperate housing situations to go, and a cruise ship would allow the social agencies to catch up with families and help them while they have a roof over their head. Cruise ship or not, the huge waves House and his colleagues have made toward the awareness of homelessness in Auckland can only bring support and more ideas for solutions.
A top ISIS leader in Afghanistan was killed in a U.S. drone strike last month, the Pentagon confirmed Friday, saying his death will affect the group's recruiting and operations in the region. Gordon Trowbridge, deputy press secretary, said Hafiz Saeed Khan died in southern Nangarhar province on July 26.
The State Department last year designated Khan as a global terrorist, saying he's the leader of the Islamic State in Khorasan, which includes former members of the Pakistani and Afghan Taliban. Khan had previously been a Tehrik-e-Taliban commander, but last year pledged loyalty to ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. U.S. and Afghan leaders have been concerned about the growth of ISIS in Afghanistan. The militants are mainly in the country's eastern region. They were targeted by a U.S.-backed Afghan military offensive last month that included American and Afghan special operations forces. And that wraps up this segment of News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to News Out of the Box Weekend Edition on Breadbox Media. I'm Kelly Sergenis.
And I'm Joe Lerza. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has shifted $81 million in funds from other projects to continue working on developing vaccines to fight Zika. in the absence of any funding from U.S. lawmakers. In a letter addressed to Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat and minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives, HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell said she was allocating $34 million in funding to the National Institutes of Health and $47 million to the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, to work on the Zika vaccine. Burwell said the funding was intended to keep Zika vaccine research going despite the lack of funding from U.S. lawmakers who left for summer recess before allocating any funding to Zika research and preparedness. The mosquito-borne Zika virus has spread to more than 50 countries and territories since the outbreak began last year in Brazil.
On Thursday, Governor Rick Scott said state health officials have identified three additional people in the affected area with locally transmitted Zika, bringing the total to 25. The Obama administration in February requested $1.9 billion to fight Zika, but congressional lawmakers have been considering a much smaller sum. A bill providing $1.1 billion was blocked by Democrats after Republicans attached language to stop abortion provider Planned Parenthood from using that government funding for health care services, mainly in U.S. territories like Puerto Rico. The Republican legislation would also siphon off unused money under President Barack Obama's signature 2010 health care law to combat Zika. In addition, Democrats balked at a Republican provision that they said would gut clean water protections. The new funds from HHS come on top of the $589 million in repurposed funds previously allocated for Ebola efforts. HHS has said these funds will run out at the end of August. At a press briefing in Washington, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says he needs $33 million to prepare to move the first potential Zika vaccine to the second phase of human clinical trials. The first phase of that testing is expected to end in late November or December. Fauci said the health secretary has the authority to transfer 1% of NIH's $33 billion budget per year from one institute to the other. He said the director of the NIH, Dr. Francis Collins, will decide which existing programs the funds will be drawn from.
He will probably do it on a prorated basis across the institutes, he said. Fauci said the budget transfer will not fill the longer-term NIH funding needs to fight the virus and to develop a second or third potential vaccine candidate. Drugs frequently fail to realize the promise they show in early trials. We still need about $196 million more, he said. Fauci said the health secretary's action was essentially one of desperation, given the failure of Congress to authorize additional funding. Taking money from other research programs is extremely damaging to the biomedical research enterprise, he said. We're taking money away from cancer, diabetes, and all those things. Dr. Lamar Hasbrook, executive director of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, said at the briefing that local health authorities are similarly siphoning off money from other programs. We're robbing Peter to pay Paul, he said. In her letter, Burwell said the $47 million in funding for BARDA will allow the agency to enter into contracts with key partners to develop vaccines. But she said BARDA will need an estimated $342 million in additional funding to continue its work with outside partners in the development of vaccines, diagnostics, and pathogen inactivation technology used to protect the U.S. blood supply.
Persistence paid off for a stray dog in Buenos Aires. Rubio, a stray dog who wandered the streets in the area, met flight attendant Olivia Sivers, who often traveled between Germany and Argentina, about 6 months ago.
Olivia showed the pup some kindness by giving him food, attention, and even a blanket, but she would have to leave for work. Olivia returned periodically, and sure enough, Rubio was always there. Rubio waited outside Olivia's hotel with his big puppy dog eyes every night. At one point, Olivia made arrangements with a rescue group to get Rubio into a good home. However, Rubio escaped. He was back at the hotel waiting for his one and only. Falling in love with the dog and his persistence, Olivia decided to adopt Rubio and brought him home with her to Germany.
Olivia has continued to keep fans of Rubio updated with his progress since his relocation. Photos on her Facebook page show him visiting a lake, going for walks with her other dogs, and loving life in his new home. And Rubio is settling in well to his new home.
He may not be comfortable with the term hero, but a homeless man is being hailed as just that. Joseph Hall, who lives in a homeless shelter in Birmingham, Alabama, spared another man who resides in the same shelter from losing his most prized possession, his wheelchair.
John Tristan Stubbs, who is homeless, has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair, was robbed at knife point on July 31st, ABC 3340 reported. When Stubbs returned to the shelter after the incident, he was locked out. Aware that Stubbs was missing, Hall went out to look for him and found Stubbs in another compromising situation. A couple of people were trying to steal his wheelchair. "I was like, you're not taking his chair. That doesn't sit well with my heart," Hall told ABC 33. Once the thieves left, Hall used all the money he had, $60, to rent a hotel room for the night so Stubbs could sleep safely.
While violence against homeless people is on the decline in the U.S., people living on the streets, those with disabilities and without, remain vulnerable to such attacks. In January, for example, in Hollywood, Florida, a woman who is homeless and uses a wheelchair was assaulted and raped, the Sun Sentinel reported. Without shelter, the homeless population is particularly vulnerable to both the elements of nature and the abuses of society, a report by the National Coalition for the Homeless noted.
The trend lately has been to criminalize and arrest homeless people and essentially make them disappear. But Albuquerque, New Mexico has taken a different track, offering them paid work. It's been almost a year since Mayor Richard Berry launched his experimental program, which involves picking up panhandlers who want to work and giving them odd jobs around the city.
In that time, the program called There's a Better Way has given out 932 jobs. Those tasks led to clearing 69,601 pounds of litter and weeds from the 196 city blocks, the Washington Post reports. More than 100 participants have secured permanent employment, according to the Post. On a given night in January last year, there were 183 unsheltered people in Albuquerque. That marked a jump from 144 in 2013. After spending a considerable amount of time with panhandlers, Berry realized that sending homeless people out of work to find work is often a futile exercise. Workers typically need identification, an address, and a decent place to shower before going on a job interview. That's when the mayor decided to bring the work to them, and his jobs program came to be. The City of Albuquerque Solid Waste Department partnered with nonprofit St. Martin's Hospitality Center to identify homeless people in need of jobs and to also offer them services to help them further get back on their feet.
Those include housing and behavioral health programs. The city loaned St. Martin's a van, and a paid driver initially circled the city twice a week seeking out panhandlers who were willing to work, according to the organization. The waste department provides a location for workers to clean up or pull weeds and also doles out safety equipment, which includes goggles, vests, and tools. They work 5.5 hours and earn $9 an hour in cash. They're also provided with lunch and water. About a year in, Albuquerque is working on expanding the program, according to the Post. The city is increasing funding for the program, and it will now operate 4 days a week instead of two. Other cities have reached out looking to replicate it. "I'm not the type of person that really likes to ask people for money. I'd rather earn it," a male participant who didn't give his name said in a video interview posted by Upworthy in January. "All I need is that one shot, and I'm not going to mess it up."
Do you enjoy listening to news out Out of the Box and other Breadbox Media shows, then become a friend of the show at breadboxmedia.com. Any little bit you can contribute helps support your favorite show hosts like us. Improvements to the Breadbox Media app are coming. Soon we will feature geolocated, community-specific content in your area. Stay tuned to Breadbox Media for details. Breadbox Media, get the app and change the world. That's your Breadbox Media News Out of the Box Weekend Edition. I'm Joe Lerza reminding you to always think out of the box.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media, get the app, change the world.